away and charged the Witcher, roaring furiously, to aim a fierce backhand blow at him. Geralt avoided the blade with a fast feint and a half turn and cut the ogre troll twice on both elbows. Bang howled, but didn't release the scimitar and took another swing, slashing broadly and chaotically. Geralt dodged, spinning beyond the blade's range. His manoeuvre carried him behind Bang's back, and he had to take advantage of a chance like that. He turned his sword around and cut from below, vertically, right between Bang's buttocks. The ogre troll seized himself by the backside, howled, squealed, hobbled, bent his knees and pissed himself. Boo, blinded, swung his scythe and struck, but not the Witcher, who had spun away in a pirouette. He struck his comrade, who was still holding himself by the buttocks, and hacked his head from his shoulders. Air escaped from the severed windpipe with a loud hiss. Blood burst from the artery like lava erupting from a volcano, high, right up to the ceiling. Bang stood, gushing blood, like a headless statue in a fountain held up by his huge flat feet. But he finally tipped over and fell like a log. Boo wiped the blood from his eyes. He roared like a buffalo when it finally dawned on him what had happened. He stamped his feet and swung his scythe. He whirled around on the spot, looking for the Witcher. He didn't find him, because the Witcher was behind him. On being cut in the armpit, he dropped the scythe, attacking Geralt with his bare hands. But the blood had blinded him again, and he careered into the wall. Geralt was upon him and slashed. Boo obviously didn't know an artery had been severed, and that he ought to have died long ago. He roared and spun around on the spot, waving his arms about, until his knees crumpled beneath him, and he dropped down in a pool of blood. Now kneeling, he roared and carried on swinging, but quieter and more drowsily. In order to end it, Geralt went in close and thrust his sword under Boo's sternum. That was a mistake. The ogre troll groaned and grabbed the blade, crossguard, and the Witcher's hand. His eyes were already misting over, but he didn't relax his grip. Geralt put a boot against his chest, braced himself, and tugged. Boo didn't let go, even though blood was spurting from his hand.
"You stupid horsen," drawled Pastor, entering the cavern and aiming at the Witcher with his double-limbed lathe arbalest. "You've come here to die, you're done for, devil-spawn. Hold him, Boo."
Geralt tugged. Boo groaned but didn't let go. The hunchback grinned and released the trigger. Geralt crouched to evade the heavy bolt and felt the fletching brush against his side before it slammed into the wall. Boo released the sword and, lying on his stomach, caught the Witcher by the legs and held him fast. Pastor croaked in triumph and raised the crossbow, but didn't manage to fire. An enormous wolf hurtled into the cavern like a grey missile. It struck Pastor in the legs from behind in the wolfish style, tearing his cruciate ligaments and popliteal artery. The hunchback yelled and fell over. The bowstring of the released arbalest clanged and Boo rasped. The bolt had struck him right in the ear and entered up to the fletching, and the bolt protruded from his other ear. Pastor howled. The wolf opened its terrible jaws and seized him by the head. The howling turned into wheezing. Geralt pushed away the finally dead ogre troll from his legs. Dusart, now in human form, stood up over Pastor's corpse and wiped his lips and chin.
"After 42 years I've been a werewolf," he said, meeting the Witcher's gaze. "It was about time I finally bit someone to death."
"I had to come," Dusart said, explaining his actions. "I knew, Master Geralt, that I had to warn you."
"About them?"
Geralt wiped his blade and pointed to the lifeless bodies.
"Not only."
The Witcher entered the room the werewolf was pointing at and stepped back involuntarily. The stone floor was black with congealed blood. A black-rimmed hole gaped in the center of the room. A pile of bodies was heaped up beside it. Naked and mutilated, cut up, quartered, occasionally with a skin flayed off them. It was difficult to estimate how many there were. The sound of bones being crunched and cracked rose up very audibly from deep in the hole.
"I wasn't able to smell it before," mumbled Dusart, in a voice full of disgust. "I only smelled it when you opened the door down there at the bottom. Let's flee from here, master, far from this charnel house. I still have something to sort out here, but you go. I thank you very much for coming to help. Don't thank me. I owed you a debt. I'm glad I was able to pay it back.
A spiral staircase led upwards, winding up a cylindrical shaft carved into the rock. It was difficult to estimate precisely, but Geralt roughly calculated that had it been a staircase in a typical tower, he would have climbed to the first, or possibly the second story. He had counted 62 steps when a door finally barred his way. Like the one down in the cave, that door also had a passage carved in it for a cat. Unlike the heavy doors in the cave, it wasn't magical, and yielded easily after the handle had been pushed down. The room he entered had no windows and was dimly lit. Beneath the ceiling hung several magical globes, but only one was active. The room stank acridly of chemicals and every possible kind of monstrosity. A quick glance revealed what it contained. Specimen jars, demijohns and flagons on shelves, retorts, glass spheres and tubes, steel instruments and tools, unmistakably a laboratory in other words. Large specimen jars were standing in a row on a bookshelf by the entrance. The nearest one was full of human eyeballs, floating in a yellow liquid like Mirabelle plums in compote. In another jar, there was a tiny homunculus, no larger than two fists held together. In a third, a human head was floating in the third jar. Geralt might not have recognized the features, which were distorted by cuts, swelling and discoloration, barely visible through the cloudy liquid and thick glass. But the head was quite bald. Only one sorcerer shaved his head. Harland Zara, it transpired, had never made it to Povis. Things were suspended in other jars, various blue and pale horrors, but there were no more heads. There was a table in the middle of the room, a steel, purpose-built table with a gutter. A naked corpse was lying on the table, a diminutive one, the remains of a child, a fair-haired little girl. The remains had been slit open with a cut in the shape of a letter Y. The internal organs, removed, had been arranged on both sides of the body, evenly, neatly and orderly. It looked just like an engraving from an anatomical atlas. All that was missing were plate numbers, figure one, figure two, and so on. He caught sight of a movement out of the corner of his eye. A large, black cat flashed by close to the wall, glanced at him, hissed, and fled through the open door. Geralt set off after him.
"Master!"
He stopped and turned around. In the corner stood a low cage resembling a chicken coop. He saw thin fingers clenching the iron bars, and then two eyes.
"Master, help me."
It was a little boy, no more than 10 years old, cowering and trembling.
"Help me."
"Shh, be quiet. You're in no danger now, but hold on a little longer. I'll be back soon to get you."
"Master, don't go."
"Be quiet," I said.
First, there was a library with dust that made his nose tingle. Then something like a drawing room. And then a bedchamber. A huge bed with a black canopy on ebony columns. He heard a rustle and turned around. Sorrel Dagerlund was standing in the doorway, coiffured in a mantle embroidered with gold stars. A smallish, quite grey creature, armed with a Zerikanian sabre, was standing beside him.
"I have a specimen jar full of formalin prepared," said the sorcerer. "For your head, you abomination. Kill him, Beta."
The creature, an incredibly fast grey apparition, an agile and noiseless grey rat, had already attacked with a whistle and a flash of the sabre before Dagerlund had finished his sentence and while he was still delighting in his own voice. Geralt avoided two blows, delivered diagonally in classic style. The first time he felt the movement of air pushed by a blade by his ear, and the second a brush on his sleeve. He parried the third blow, and for a moment they crossed swords. He saw the face of the grey creature, its large yellow eyes with vertical pupils, narrow slits instead of a nose, and pointed ears. The creature had no mouth at all. They parted. The creature turned around nimbly, attacked at once with an ethereal dancing step, once again diagonally, once again predictably. It was inhumanly energetic, incredibly agile, hellishly swift, but stupid. It had no idea how fast a witcher could be after drinking his elixirs. Geralt allowed it only one blow, which he outmaneuvered. Then he attacked with a trained sequence of movements he had practiced 100 times. He encircled the great creature with a fast half-turn, executed a deceptive feint, and slashed it across the collarbone. The blood hadn't even had time to spurt when he slashed it under the arm, and jumped aside, ready for more. But no more was needed. It turned out that the creature did have a mouth. It opened in the grey face like a wound, splitting widely from ear to ear, although no more than half an inch. But the creature didn't utter a word or a sound. It fell onto its knees, and then its side. For a moment it twitched, moving its limbs like a dog dreaming, and died in silence. It was then that Dagoland committed an error. Rather than fleeing, he raised both hands and began to bark out a spell in a furious voice full of rage and hatred. Flames whirled around his hands, forming a fiery globe. It looked a little like candy floss being made. It even smelled similar. Dagoland didn't manage to create a complete globe. He had no idea how fast a witcher could be after drinking his elixirs. Geralt was upon him and cut across the globe in the sorcerer's hands. There was a roar, like a furnace being ignited, and sparks flew. Dagoland yelled, releasing the flaming globe from his bloodied hands. The globe went out, filling the chamber with a smell of burning caramel. Geralt dropped his sword. He slapped Dagoland hard in the face with his open palm. The sorcerer screamed, cowered, and turned his back on him. The witcher seized him, caught him by a buckle, and clasped his neck in his forearm. Dagoland yelled and began to kick out.
"You cannot," he wailed. "You cannot kill me. It is forbidden. I am a human being."
Geralt tightened his forearm around his neck. Not too tightly at first.
"It wasn't me," wailed the sorcerer. "It was Ortolan. Ortolan forced me. He forced me. And Meruta Ekati knew about everything. She did. Meruta. That medallion was her idea. She made me do it."
The witcher tightened his grip.
"Help! Somebody help me!"
Geralt tightened his grip.
"Somebody help! No!"
Dagoland wheezed, saliva dripping copiously from his mouth. Geralt turned his head away and tightened his grip. Dagoland lost consciousness and went limp. Tighter. The hyoid bone cracked. Tighter. His larynx gave way. Tighter. Even tighter. The cervical vertebrae cracked and dislocated. Geralt held Dagoland up a moment longer. Then he jerked the sorcerer's head hard sideways to be quite certain. Then he let him go. The sorcerer slid down onto the floor, softly like a silk cloth. The witcher wiped the saliva from his sleeve on a curtain. The large black cat appeared from nowhere. It rubbed itself against Dagoland's body, licked his motionless hand, meowed and cried mournfully. It lay down beside the corpse, cuddling up against its side, and looked at the witcher with its wide-open golden eyes.
"I had to," said the witcher. "It was necessary. If anyone, you ought to understand."
The cat narrowed its eyes to indicate it did. For God's sake, let us sit upon the ground and tell sad stories of the death of kings, how some have been deposed, some slain in war, some haunted by the ghosts they have deposed, some poisoned by their wives, some sleeping killed, all murdered. William Shakespeare, Richard II. Chapter 18. The weather on the day of the royal wedding had been wonderful from early morning. The blue sky over Kerak not sullied by even a single cloud. It had been very warm since the morning, but the hot weather was tempered by a sea breeze. There had been a commotion in the upper town from the early morning. The streets and squares had been thoroughly swept, the house fronts decorated with ribbons and garlands and pennants put on flagpoles. Since the morning, a line of suppliers had streamed along the road leading to the royal palace. Laden wagons and carts passed empty ones on their way back, and porters, craftsmen, merchants, messengers and couriers ran up the hill. Some time after, The road had teemed with sedan chairs carrying wedding guests to the palace.
"My nuptials are no laughing matter," King Belohan was heard to have said. "My nuptials will become lodged in people's memory and talked about through the whole wide world."
On the order of the king, the celebrations were thus meant to begin in the morning and last long into the night. The guests would be facing quite unprecedented attractions throughout the whole day. Kerak was a tiny kingdom, and actually fairly insignificant. Hence, Geralt doubted whether the world was particularly bothered about Beloan's nuptials, even though he had decided to hold balls the entire week and God knows what attractions he had come up with. And there was no chance the people living more than 100 miles away could have heard of the event. But to Beloan, as was universally known, the city of Kerak was the centre of the world, and the world was the small region surrounding Kerak. Geralt and Dandelion were both dressed as elegantly as they could manage, and the Witcher had even purchased for the celebrations a brand new calfskin jacket, for which he had paid well over the odds. As for Dandelion, he had announced from the beginning that he would scorn the royal nuptials and take no part in them, for he had been added to the guest list as a relative of the royal instigator, and not as the world-famous poet and bard. And he had not been invited to perform. Dandelion regarded that as a slight and took umbrage. As was customary with him, his resentment didn't last long, no more than half a day. Flagpoles were erected along the entire road winding up the hillside to the palace, and on them hung yellow pennants with the coat of arms of Kerak, a blue dolphin Nand, with red fins and tail, languidly fluttering in the breeze. Dandelion's kinsman, Theron de Lettenhover, assisted by several royal guardsmen wearing livery with the heraldic dolphin, in other words, blue and red, was waiting for them outside the entrance to the palace complex. The instigator greeted Dandelion and called over a page who was charged with assisting the poet and escorting him to the place of the party.
"And I would ask you, my Lord Geralt, to come with me."
They walked through the grounds along a side avenue, passing an area obviously used for utilities, from where they could hear the clank of pots and kitchen utensils, as well as the vile insults the chefs were dishing out to the kitchen porters. On top of that, however, was the pleasant and appetizing smell of food. Geralt knew the menu, and knew what the guests would be served during the wedding party. A few days before, he and Dandelion had visited the Natura Rerum Osteria. Fabus Ravenger, not concealing his pride, had boasted that he and several other restaurateurs were organizing the feast and composing a list of dishes for the preparation of which only the most distinguished of local chefs would be hired.
"Sautéed oysters, sea urchins, prawns and crabs will be served for breakfast," he had said. "For a mid-morning snack there will be meat jellies and various pasties, smoked and marinated salmon, duck in aspic, sheep and goat's cheese. For luncheon there will be ad libitum, meat or fish broth. On top of that, meat or fish patties, tripe with liver meatballs, grilled monkfish glazed with honey, and sea perch with saffron and cloves. Afterwards," Ravenger intoned, modulating his breathing like a trained orator, "will be served cuts of roast meat in white sauce with capers, eggs and mustard, swan's knees in honey, capons draped in fatback, partridges and quince conserve, roast pigeon and mutton liver pie with barley groats, salads and diverse vegetables, then caramels, nougats, stuffed cakes, roast chestnuts, preserves and marmalades. Wine from Toussaint, naturally, will be served continuously and without pause."
Ravenger described it so vividly it was mouth-watering. Geralt doubted, however, that he would manage to taste anything from the extensive menu. He was by no means a guest at the nuptials. He was in a worse situation than the pages, who could always pluck some morsels from the dishes, or at least stick a finger in the creams, sauces or forcemeats as they hurried by. The main location of the celebrations was the palace grounds, once the temple orchard, with modifications and extensions by the kings of Kerak, mainly in the form of colonnades, bowers and temples of contemplation. Today, many colourful pavilions had been additionally erected among the trees and buildings, and sheets of canvas stretched over poles offered shelter from the heat of the day. A small crowd of guests had already gathered. There weren't meant to be too many, some 200 in total. It was rumoured that the king himself had drawn up the list, and only a select circle, la creme de la creme itself, would be receiving invitations. For Beloan, it turned out, his close and distant relatives constituted the larger part of the elite. Aside from them, the local high society, key administrative officials, and the wealthiest local and foreign businessmen and diplomats, meaning spies from neighbouring countries posing as commercial attachés, had also been invited. The list was completed by quite a large group of sycophants, grovellers and preeminent arse-kissers. Prince Egmund was waiting outside one of the side entrances to the palace, dressed in a short black jacket with rich silver and gold embroidery. He was accompanied by a few young men. They all had long, curled hair, and were wearing padded doublets and tight hose with terribly fashionable and excessively large codpieces. Geralt didn't like the look of them, not just because of the mocking glances they were shooting at his apparel. They reminded him too much of Sorrel Dagerlund. At the sight of the instigator and the witcher, the prince immediately dismissed his entourage. Only one individual remained. He had short hair and wore normal trousers. In spite of that, Geralt didn't like the look of him either. He had strange eyes and an unprepossessing look. Geralt bowed before the prince. The prince didn't return the bow naturally. "Hand over your sword," he said to Geralt, right after his greeting. "You may not parade around with a weapon. Don't fret. Although you won't see your sword, it will be close at hand the whole time. I've issued orders. Should anything occur, the sword will immediately be returned to you. Captain Ropp here will take charge of that."
"And what's the likelihood of anything happening?"
"Were there no chance or little chance, would I be bothering you?" Egmund examined the scabbard and blade.
"Oh, a sword from Virileda. Not a sword, but a work of art.
I know, for I once had a similar one. My half-brother, Veraxus, stole it from me. When my father banished him, he appropriated a great deal of things that didn't belong to him before leaving. No doubt as souvenirs." Theron de Lettenhover cleared his throat. Geralt recalled Dandelion's words. It was forbidden to utter the name of the banished firstborn son at court. But Egmund was clearly ignoring the prohibitions.
"A work of art," repeated the prince, still examining the sword.
"Without asking how you came by it, I congratulate you on the acquisition, but I can't believe the stolen ones were any better than this."
"That's a matter of taste and preference. I prefer to recover the stolen ones. Your Royal Highness and my Lord Instigator vouched that you would find the thief. It was, I take the liberty of recalling, the condition on which I undertook the task of protecting the king. The condition has clearly not been met."
"It clearly hasn't," Egmund admitted coldly, handing the sword to Captain Ropp, the man with the malevolent gaze. "I thus feel obliged to compensate you for it. Instead of the 300 crowns I had planned to pay you for your services, you will receive 500. I also add that the investigation regarding your swords is ongoing, and you may yet recover them. Ferron allegedly has a suspect, haven't you?"
"The investigation explicitly indicated the person of Nikifor Mouas, a municipal and judicial clerk," Ferron de Lettenhover announced dryly. "He has fled, but his recapture is imminent."
"I trust so," the prince snorted. "It can't be such a feat to catch an ink-stained petty clerk, who in addition must have acquired piles from sitting at a desk, which hinder escape both on foot and horseback. How did he manage to escape at all?" "We are dealing with a very volatile person," the instigator cleared his throat, "and probably a madman. Before he vanished, he caused a revolting scene in Ravenga's restaurant concerning, forgive me, human feces. The restaurant had to be closed for some time because..." "I shall spare you the gory details. The stolen swords were not discovered during a search carried out at Mercer's lodgings, but instead, forgive me, a leather satchel filled to the brim with..."
"Enough, enough, I can guess what," Egmund grimaced.
"Yes, that indeed says a great deal about the individual's psychological state. Your swords, Witcher, have probably been lost, then. Even if Ferron captures him, he won't learn anything from a madman. It's not even worth torturing men like him. They only talk gibberish on the rack. And now forgive me, duty calls." Ferron de Lettenhover escorted Geralt towards the main entrance to the palace grounds. Shortly after, they found themselves in a stone-slabbed courtyard, where seneschals were greeting the guests as they arrived, and guardsmen and pages were escorting them further into the grounds.
"What may I expect?"
"I beg your pardon?"
"What may I expect today? What part of that didn't you understand?"
"Prince Xander has boasted in front of witnesses that he will be crowned king tomorrow," said the instigator in a low voice. "But it isn't the first time he's said that, and he's always been in his cups when he has."
"Is he capable of carrying out a coup?"
"Not especially. But he has a camarilla, confidants and favourites. They are more capable."
"How much proof is there in the rumour that Balohan will today announce as his successor the son his betrothed is carrying?"
"Quite some.
And Egmund, who's losing his chances for the throne, lo and behold, is hiring a witcher to guard and protect his father. What commendable filial love.
Don't digress. You took on the task, now execute it.
I did, and I shall. Although it's extremely vague. I don't know who, if anything happens, will be pitted against me. But I probably ought to know who will support me if anything happens.
If such a need arises, the sword, as the prince promised, will be given to you by Captain Rob. He will also back you up. I shall help as far as I am able, because I wish you well.
Since when?
I beg your pardon.
We've never spoken face to face. Dandelion has always been with us, and I didn't want to bring up the subject with him there. The detailed documentation about my alleged frauds. How did Egmont come by it? Who forged it? Not him, of course. You did, Ferron.
I had nothing to do with it, I assure you. You're a rotten liar for a guardian of the law. It's a mystery how you landed your position.
Ferron de Lettenhover pursed his lips.
I had to, he said. I was carrying out orders.
The Witcher looked long and hard at him.
You wouldn't believe how many times I've heard similar words, he finally said. But it's comforting to think that it was usually from the mouths of men who were about to hang.
Litanair was among the guests. He spotted her easily, because she looked eye-catching. The bodice of her vivid green crepe-de-chine gown, with its plunging neckline, was decorated with embroidery in the form of a stylized butterfly, sparkling with tiny sequins. It was edged with frills. Frilly dresses on women older than 10 usually evoked ironic sympathy in The Witcher, while on Litter's dress they harmonized with the rest of it with more than attractive results. The sorceress's neck was adorned with a necklace of polished emeralds, none smaller than an almond, and one considerably larger. Her red hair was like a forest fire. Motzaik was standing at Litter's side, in a black and astonishingly bold dress of silken chiffon, quite transparent on the shoulders and sleeves. The girl's neck and cleavage were veiled in something like a fancifully draped chiffon ruff, which, in combination with the long black sleeves, gave her figure an aura of flamboyance and mystery. They were both wearing 4-inch heels. Litter's were made of iguana skin, and Motzaik's of patent leather. Geralt hesitated to approach for a moment. But only a moment.
"Greetings," Litter said guardedly. "What a pleasant surprise. It's lovely to see you. Motzaik, you won. The white slippers are yours."
"A wager," he guessed. "What did it concern?"
"You? I thought we wouldn't see you again, and wagered that you wouldn't show up. Motzaik took the bet, because she thought differently."
Litter gave him a deep, jade-green glance, clearly waiting for a response. For a word, for anything. Geralt remained silent.
"Greetings, fair ladies," said Dandelion, springing up from nowhere, a veritable deus ex machina. "My respects, I bow before your beauty. Madam Nair, Miss Motzaik, forgive the absence of flowers."
"We forgive you. What of the arts?"
"All that you'd expect, everything and nothing," said Dandelion, snatching 2 goblets of wine from a passing page and handing them to the women. "The party's somewhat dull, isn't it? But the wine's good. Est est. 40 a pint. The red's not bad either. I've tried it. Just don't drink the hippocras. They don't know how to spice it. And there's no end of guests. Have you seen? As usual in high society, the race is back to front. It's Arabour. Whoever arrives last wins and claims the laurels, and will have a splendid entrance. I think we're observing the finish right now. The owner of a chain of lumber mills and wife are crossing the finishing line, losing out in the process to the harbour master and wife, who are just behind, who in turn are losing out to a dandy I don't know."
"That's the head of the Kaviran commercial mission. And wife," explained Coral. "I wonder whose."
"Parrel Pratt, that old villain, will make it into the leading pack. With a pretty good-looking partner. Bloody hell!"
"What's the matter?"
"The woman beside Pratt."
Dandelion choked.
Is Etna a cider? The little widow who sold me the sword?"
"Is that how she introduced herself?" snorted Litter. "Etna a cider? A cheap anagram. She's Antea Deris, Pratt's eldest daughter, and no little widow, for she's never married. Rumour has it she isn't fond of men."
"Pratt's daughter? Impossible! I visited him, but you didn't meet her there." The sorceress cut him off. Nothing strange. Antea doesn't get on very well with her family. She doesn't even use her surname, but an alias made up of two given names. She only contacts her father regarding her business affairs, which, as a matter of fact, are booming. But I'm surprised to see them here together.
They must have their reasons, the witcher observed astutely.
I dread to think what. Officially, Antea is a commercial agent, but her favourite spots are swindles, fraud and rackets. Poet, I have a favour to ask. You're worldly wise, but Mozaic isn't. Lead her among the guests and introduce her to anyone worth knowing. And point out any who aren't. Assuring Coral that her wish was his command, Dandelion proffered Mozaic his arm. They were left alone. Come. Litter interrupted the lengthening silence. Let's take a walk. Up that little hill over there. A view of the city, Palmyra, the harbour and the sea, spread out from high up on the hill, from the Temple of Contemplation. Litter shielded her eyes with a hand.
What's that sailing into harbour? And dropping anchor? A three-masted frigate of curious construction? Under black sails? Huh, that's quite remarkable.
Forget the frigates. Dandelion and Mozaic having been sent away, we're alone and out of the way.
And you're wondering why?
She turned around.
Waiting for me to tell you something. You're waiting for the questions I shall ask you. But perhaps I only want to tell you the latest gossip? From the wizarding community? Oh, no, never fear. It's not about Yennefer. It's about Risberg, a place you know well, after all. Plenty of changes have taken place there. But I fail to see the glint of curiosity in your eyes. Shall I go on?
By all means, do.
It began when Ortolan died.
Ortolan's dead?
He passed away almost a week ago. According to the official version, he was lethally poisoned by the fertilizer he was working on. But rumour has it that it was a stroke caused by the news of the sudden death of one of his favourites, who died as a result of an unsuccessful and highly suspicious experiment. I'm talking about a certain Dagerland. Does that name ring a bell? Did you meet him when you were at the castle?
I may have. I met many sorcerers. They weren't all memorable.
Ortolan apparently blamed the entire council at Risberg for his favourite's death, became enraged and suffered a stroke. He was really very old and had suffered from high blood pressure. His addiction to fishtech was an open secret, and fishtech and high blood pressure are a potent mixture. But there must have been something fishy, because significant staffing changes have taken place at Risberg. Even before Ottolan's death, there had been conflicts. Algernon Gwynkamp, more commonly known as Pinity, was forced to resign, among others. You remember him, I'm certain, because if anyone was memorable there, he was.
Indeed.
Ottolan's death,
Coral glared at him keenly, provoked a swift response from the chapter, who had much earlier been aware of some worrying tidings concerning the antics of the deceased and his favourite. Interestingly, and increasingly typically in our times, a tiny pebble triggered the landslide. An insignificant commoner, an overzealous shire reeve or constable. He forced his superior, the bailiff from Gorsvalen, to take action. The bailiff took the accusations higher up, and thus, rung by rung, the affair reached the royal council and thence the chapter. To keep things brief, people were accused of negligence. Biruta Icarte had to leave the board. She went back to lecture at Aretusa. Pockmarked Axel and Sandoval left. San Janis kept his job, gaining the chapter's pardon by informing on the others and shifting all the blame onto them. What do you say to that? Do you have anything to say?
What can I say? It's your business, and your scandals.
Scandals that erupted at Risberg soon after your visit.
You overrate me, Coral, and my influence.
I never overrate anything, and seldom underrate.
Mozaic and Dandelion will be back any moment, he said, looking her in the eyes. And after all, you didn't bring me here without a reason. Will you tell me what this is about?
She withstood his gaze.
You know very well what this is about, she replied. So don't offend my intelligence by lowering your own.
You haven't come to see me in over a month. No, don't think I desire mawkish melodrama or pathetic sentimental gestures. I don't expect anything more from the relationship that's finishing than a pleasant memory.
It seems to me you use the word relationship. Its semantic capacity is indeed astounding.
Nothing but a pleasant memory, she said, ignoring his comment and holding his gaze. I don't know what it's like for you, but as far as I'm concerned, I'll be frank, things aren't that good. It would, I think, be worth making some serious efforts to that end. I don't think much would be necessary. Why, something small but nice. A nice final note, something to leave a pleasant memory. Could you manage something like that? Would you like to visit me? He didn't manage to answer. The bell in the belfry began to toll deafeningly, striking 10 times. Then trumpets sounded a loud, brassy and slightly cacophonous fanfare. The crowd of guests was parted by blue and red guardsmen forming a double line. The marshal of the court appeared beneath the portico in the entrance to the palace, wearing a gold chain around his neck and holding a staff as big as a fence post. Behind him strode heralds, and behind the heralds, seneschals, and behind the seneschals, wearing a sable calpac and holding a scepter, marched Bilohan, king of Kerak, in bony and wiry person. At his side walked a willowy young blonde in a veil, who could only have been the royal betrothed, and in the very near future his wife and queen. The blonde was wearing a snow-white dress, and was bedecked in diamonds, perhaps rather too lavishly, in a rather nouveau riche and rather tasteless style. Like the king, she bore on her shoulders an ermine cloak which was held by pages. The royal family followed on behind the royal couple, at least a dozen paces behind the pages holding the train, which spoke volumes about their status. Egmund was there, naturally, and beside him a man as fair-skinned as an albino, who could only have been his brother Xander. Beyond the brothers walked the rest of the relatives, several men, several women, and a few teenaged boys and girls, evidently the king's legitimate and illegitimate offspring. Amid the bowing male and low-curtsying female guests, the royal procession reached its destination, which was a raised platform somewhat resembling a scaffold. 2 thrones had been placed on the platform, which was roofed over by a canopy and covered at the sides by tapestries. The king and the bride sat down on the thrones. The rest of the family had to stand. The trumpets assaulted the ears a second time with their brassy braying. The marshal of the court, brandishing his arms like a conductor in front of an orchestra, encouraged the guests to shout, cheer and toast the duo. The guests and courtiers tried to outdo each other by showering the soon-to-be-wed couple from all sides with wishes for eternal good health, happiness, success, long, longer and even longer lives. King Bilohan maintained his haughty and huffy expression, and only demonstrated his pleasure with the good wishes, compliments and praises being sung to him and his bride-to-be, by subtle twitches of his scepter. The marshal of the court silenced the guests, and gave a long speech, smoothly shifting from grandiloquence to bombast and back again. Geralt devoted all his attention to watching the crowd, hence he only listened with half an ear. King Bilohan, the marshal of the court proclaimed to all and sundry, was genuinely glad that so many people had come, was overjoyed to welcome everybody on such an auspicious occasion, and wished them precisely the same as they wished him. The wedding ceremony would be taking place in the afternoon, and until then the guests were invited to eat, drink and be merry, and avail themselves of the numerous attractions planned for the event. The braying of the trumpets proclaimed the end of the official part. The royal procession began to leave the gardens. Among the guests, Geralt had managed to observe several small groups behaving quite suspiciously. One group in particular bothered him, because they hadn't bowed to the procession as low as the others, and were attempting to shove their way towards the palace gate. He drifted towards the double file of soldiers in blue and red. Litter walked beside him. Bilohan strode with his eyes fixed straight ahead. The bride-to-be was looking around, occasionally nodding at the guests, greeting her. A gust of wind raised her veil for a moment. Geralt saw her large blue eyes. He saw those eyes suddenly find Litter near amid the throng, and saw the eyes light up with hatred. Pure, unadulterated, distilled hatred. It lasted a second, and then the trumpets resounded, the procession passed, and the guardsmen marched on. The suspiciously behaving little group had, as it turned out, only been aiming at the table laden with wine and hors d'oeuvre, which they besieged and stripped ahead of the other guests.
Performances began on makeshift stages dotted here and there. Musicians played fiddles, lyres, pipes and recorders, and choirs sang. Jugglers took turns with tumblers, strongmen made way for acrobats, and tightrope walkers were replaced by scantily clad dancers with tambourines. People became merrier and merrier. The ladies' cheeks began to glow, the gentlemen's foreheads to glisten with sweat, and the speech of both the former and the latter became very loud and somewhat incoherent. Litter pulled him beyond a pavilion. They surprised a couple that had concealed themselves there for explicitly sexual purposes. The sorceress wasn't bothered and paid almost no attention to them. "I don't know what's afoot," she said, "and I don't know why you're here, though I can guess. But keep your eyes open, and anything you do, do with prudence. The royal betrothed is none other than Ildiko Brekel."
"I won't ask you if you know her. I saw that look."
"Ildiko Brekel," Coral repeated. "That's her name. She was chuffed out of Aretusa in the third year for petty theft. She's done well for herself, as you can see. She didn't become a sorceress, but she'll be a queen in a few hours. The cherry on the tart, damn it. She's only meant to be 17. The old fool. Ildiko is a good 25.
And appears not to like you.
The feeling's mutual. She's a born schemer. Trouble always follows her around. But that's not all. The frigate that sailed into the harbour under black sails? I know what she is. I've heard about her. She's Acherontia, and is extremely infamous. Wherever she appears, something happens.
What, for example?
She has a crew of mercenaries who can allegedly be hired to do anything. And what do you hire mercenaries for? Bricklaying?
I have to go. Forgive me, Coral.
Whatever occurs, she said slowly, looking him in the eyes, whatever happens, I can't be embroiled in it.
Never fear. I don't mean to ask for your help.
You misunderstood me.
No doubt. Forgive me, Coral.
Just beyond the ivy-grown colonnade, he bumped into Mozaik, coming the other way. Astonishingly calm and cool among the heat, hubbub and commotion.
"Where's Dandelion? Did he leave you?"
"He did," she sighed, "but excused himself politely, and also asked me to apologize to you. He was invited to perform in private, in the palace chambers for the queen and her ladies-in-waiting. He couldn't refuse."
"Who asked him?"
"A man with a soldierly look and a strange expression in his eyes."
"I have to go. Forgive me, Mozaik."
A small crowd had gathered beyond the pavilion, which was decorated with colourful ribbons. Food was being served, pasties, salmon and duck in aspic. Geralt cleared a path for himself, looking out for Captain Ropp or Ferron de Lettenhover. Instead, he ran straight into Favors Ravenga. The restaurateur resembled an aristocrat. He was dressed in a brocade doublet, while his head was adorned with a hat bearing a plume of ostrich feathers. He was accompanied by Pyrrell Pratt's daughter, chic and elegant, in a black male outfit.
"Ah, oh, Geralt," said Ravenga, looking pleased. "And Thea, let me introduce you. Geralt of Rivia, the famous witcher. Geralt, this is Madame Antea Deris, commercial agent. Have a glass of wine with us."
"Forgive me, but I'm in a hurry," he apologized.
"I'm aware of Madame Antea, although I haven't met her personally.
In your shoes, I wouldn't buy anything from her, Phoebus."
The portico of the palace entrance had been decorated by some scholarly linguist with a banner reading Crescite et Multiplicamini, and Geralt was stopped by crossed halberd shafts.
"No entry. I have to see the royal instigator urgently."
"No entry."
The commander of the guard emerged from behind the halberdiers. He was holding a half-pike in his left hand. He aimed the dirty index finger of his right hand straight at Geralt's nose.
"No entry. Do you understand, sire?"
"If you don't take that finger away from my face, I'll break it in several places."
"Ah, precisely. That's much better.
And now take me to the instigator."
"Whenever you happen upon guards, there's always a row," said Ferron de Lettenhover from behind the witcher. He must have followed Geralt.
"It's a grave character flaw, and may have disagreeable consequences.
I don't like it when anybody bars my way.
But that's what guards and sentries are for, after all. It wouldn't be necessary if there was free entry everywhere. Let him through."
"We have orders from the king himself," the commander of the guard frowned, "but to wait no one without being searched."
"Then search him."
The search was thorough, and the guardsman took it seriously. They searched him thoroughly, not limiting themselves to a cursory pat. They didn't find anything. Geralt hadn't taken the dagger he usually carried stuck down his boot to the wedding.
Happy? Asked the instigator, looking down at the commander. Now step aside and let us through.
May your excellency forgive me, the commander drawled. The king's order was unequivocal. It applied to everyone.
Whatever next? Don't forget yourself, lad. Do you know who stands before you?
Everyone is to be searched, said the commander, nodding towards the guardsman. The order was clear. Please don't make problems. Your excellency, for us, or for yourself.
What's happening today?
Regarding that, please see my superiors. They ordered me to search everybody.
The instigator swore under his breath and yielded to the search. He didn't even have a penknife.
I'd like to know what this is all about, he said, when they were finally walking along the corridor. I'm seriously perturbed. Seriously perturbed, Witcher.
Did you see Dandelion? He was apparently summoned to the palace to sing.
I know nothing of that.
But did you know that the Acherontia has sailed into harbour? Does that name mean anything to you?
A great deal, and my anxiety grows by the minute. Let's make haste.
Guardsmen, armed with partisans, were moving around the vestibule, once the temple cloisters, and blue and red uniforms also flitted through the cloisters. The clatter of boots and raised voices reached them from the corridor.
I say, said the instigator, beckoning at a passing soldier. Sergeant, what's going on here?
Forgive me, Your Excellency. I'm hurrying with orders.
Stand still, I say. What's going on? I demand an explanation. Is something the matter? Where is Prince Egmont?
Mr. Ferald de Lettenhover.
King Valohan himself stood in a doorway, beneath standards bearing the blue dolphin, accompanied by four sturdy tufts in leather jerkins. He had disposed of his royal trappings, so he didn't look like a king. He looked like a peasant whose cow had just calved and given birth to a gorgeous specimen.
Mr. Ferrand de Lettenhover.
Joy at the calf could also be heard in the king's voice.
The royal instigator. I mean, my instigator. Or perhaps not mine. Perhaps my son's. You appear, although I haven't summoned you. In principle, being here at this moment was your professional duty, but I didn't summon you. Let Ferrand, I thought to myself, let Ferrand eat, drink, pick up a bit of skirt and shagger in the bower. I won't summon him, I don't want him here. Do you know why I didn't want you? Because I wasn't certain who you serve. Whom do you serve, Ferrand?
I serve your majesty, replied the instigator, bowing low. And I'm utterly devoted to your majesty.
Did you all hear that?
Asked the king, looking around theatrically.
Ferrand is devoted to me. Very well, Ferrand. Very well. I expected an answer like that, O royal instigator. You may remain. You will come in useful. I shall at once charge you with a task befitting an instigator. I say. And this one? Who is it? Just a minute. Could it be that witcher who engages in swindles, whom the sorceress fingered?
He turned out to be innocent. The sorceress was misled. He had been informed upon.
The innocent are not informed upon.
It was a decision of the court.
The case was closed owing to lack of evidence.
But there was a case, meaning there was a stink. Decisions of the court and its verdicts derive from the imaginations and caprices of court officers, while the stink issues from the very nub of the case. That's all I wish to say. I won't waste time on lectures about jurisprudence. On the day of my marriage, I can show magnanimity, not order him locked up. But get that witcher out of my sight at once, and may he never darken my door again.
Your Majesty, I am perturbed. Acherontia has allegedly sailed into port. In this situation, safety considerations dictate the need for protection. The witcher could...
Could what? Shield me with his own bosom? Paralyze the assassins with a witcher's spell? For did Egmont, my loving son, charge him with such a task? To protect his father and ensure his safety? Step this way, Ferrand. Why, and you bloody come too, witcher. I'll show you something. You'll see how one takes care of one's own safety and guarantees one's self-protection. Have a good look. Listen. Perhaps you'll learn something and find something out about yourselves. Come on, follow me.
They set off, urged by the king and surrounded by the bruisers in leather jerkins. They entered a large room where a throne stood on a dais beneath a plafond decorated with waves and sea monsters. Belohan seated himself on the throne. Opposite, beneath a fresco portraying a stylized map of the world, the king's sons sat on a bench, guarded by other bruisers. The princes of Kerak. The coal-black-haired Egmund and the albino blonde, Xander. Belohan sat back comfortably on his throne. He looked down on his sons with the air of a victorious commander before whom kneel his enemies, crushed in battle, begging for mercy. However, the victors on the paintings Geralt had seen usually wore expressions of gravity, dignity, nobility, and magnanimity for the vanquished. One would have searched in vain for that on Belohan's face. It was painted with nothing but scathing derision.
"My court jester fell ill yesterday," spoke the king. "He came down with the shits. What bad luck, I thought. There'd be no jokes, no japes, no fun and games. I was wrong. It's funny. So funny, it's side-splitting. For you two, my sons, are hilarious. Pathetic, but hilarious. In the coming years, I guarantee, lying in bed with my little wife after amorous capers and frolics, whenever we recall you and this day, we shall laugh until we weep, for there's nothing funnier than a fool."
Xander, it was readily apparent, was afraid. His eyes were sweeping over the chamber, and he was sweating profusely. Egmund, on the contrary, didn't evince any fear. He looked his father straight in the eyes, and returned the derision as his father spoke on.
"Folk wisdom declares, hope for the best, expect the worst. So I was prepared for the worst. For could there be anything worse than betrayal by one's own sons? I placed agents among your most trusted comrades. Your accomplices betrayed you immediately as soon as I put the screws on them. Your factotums and favourites are right now fleeing the city. Yes, my sons, you thought me deaf and blind, old, senile and decrepit. You thought I couldn't see that you both craved the throne and crown, that you desired them like a swine desires truffles. A swine that sniffs out a truffle loses its head from desire, lust, urges and untamed appetite. The swine goes insane, squeals, burrows, paying no heed, as long as it can get hold of the truffles. You need to whack it severely with a stick to drive it away. And you, my sons, turned out to be just such swine. You sniffed out a mushroom and went berserk with lust and cravings. But you'll receive shit and no truffles, though you will taste a thrashing. You acted against me, my sons. You violated my authority and person. The health of people who act against me usually deteriorates violently. It's a fact confirmed by medical science. The frigate Acherontia has dropped anchor in the harbour. It sailed here on my orders. It was I who commissioned the captain. The court will convene tomorrow morning, and the verdict will be reached before noon, and at noon the two of you will be aboard the ship. They'll only allow you to disembark once the frigate passes the lighthouse at Paysa de Mar, which means, in practical terms, that your new place of abode will be Nazir, Ebbing, Mecht, or Nilfgaard, or the very end of the world and the gates of hell, if it's your will to travel there, for you shall never return to these parts, ever, if you want your heads to remain on your shoulders.
You mean to banish us, howled Xander, as you banished Viraxas. Will you also forbid our names from being mentioned at court?
I banished Viraxas in wrath and without a judgment, which doesn't mean I wouldn't have him beheaded should he dare to return. The tribunal will sentence you to exile, legally and bindingly.
Are you so sure of that? We shall see. We shall see what the court has to say about such lawlessness.
The court knows what verdict I expect, and that's the one it will pronounce, unanimously.
Like hell it'll be unanimous. The courts are independent in this country.
The courts, maybe. But the judges aren't. You're a fool, Xander. Your mother was as thick as two short planks and you take after her. You certainly didn't concoct the murder plot yourself. One of your favourites planned it all. But actually, I'm glad you did. I'll gleefully rid myself of you. It's different with Egmund. Yes, Egmund is cunning. The Witcher, hired by the caring son to protect his father. Ah, how shrewdly you kept that a secret, so that everybody found out. And then the contact poison. A wily thing, poison like that. My food and drink is tasted, but who would have thought of the handle of the poker from the fireplace in the royal bedchamber? The poker I use and don't let anybody touch. Cunning, my son, cunning. Pity that your poisoner betrayed you, but that's the way it is. Traitors betray traitors. Why do you say nothing, Egmund? Do you have nothing to say?
Egmund's eyes were cold and still showed no traces of fear. He isn't at all daunted by the prospect of banishment, thought Geralt. He isn't thinking about banishment or going into exile. Isn't thinking about Acherontia. Isn't thinking about Pays de Mar. So what is he thinking about?
Nothing to say, son,
repeated the king. Only one thing, Egwene said through pursed lips. From the folk wisdom you're so fond of. There's no fool like an old fool. Remember my words, father dear, when the time comes.
Take them away. Lock them up and guard them, ordered Bellohan. That's your job, Ferrell. The job of the instigator. And now call the tailor in here, the marshal of the court and the notary. Everyone else, out. And you, witcher. You've learned something today, haven't you? Have you learned something about yourself? Namely, that you're a naive chump? If you've understood that, then there'll be some benefit from your visit today. A visit which has just finished. Hi, over there, two men to me. Escort this witcher to the gate and eject him from it, making sure first that he hasn't swiped any of the silverware.
Captain Ropp barred their way in the corridor outside the throne room, accompanied by two individuals with similar eyes, movements, and bearing. Geralt would have wagered that all three of them had once served in the same unit. He suddenly understood. He suddenly realized he knew what was about to happen, how things would develop. Thus, it came as no surprise to him when Ropp announced he was taking control of the escort and ordered the guardsmen away. The Witcher knew the captain would order him to follow. As he had expected, the other two men were close behind. He had a foreboding about who he would find in the chamber they were about to enter. Dandelion was as white as a sheet and clearly terrified, but probably unharmed. He was sitting on a chair with a high backrest. Behind the chair stood a skinny character with hair combed and plaited into a queue. The character was holding a misericord with a long, narrow, four-sided blade. The blade was pressed against the poet's neck, below his jaw, slanting upwards.
No funny business, warned Rob. No funny business, Witcher. One false move, even one twitch, and Mr. Samsa will stick the minstrel like a hog. He won't hesitate.
Geralt knew that Mr. Samsa wouldn't hesitate, because Mr. Samsa's eyes were even nastier than Rop's. They were eyes with a very specific expression. People with eyes like that could occasionally be come across in morgues and anatomy laboratories. They weren't employed there by any means to support themselves, but to have the opportunity to indulge their dark predilections. Geralt now understood why Prince Egmund had been so calm, why he had been looking ahead fearlessly, and into his father's eyes.
"We ask you to be obedient," said Rob. "If you're obedient, you'll both get out alive. Do what we ask, and we'll release you and the poetaster," the captain continued to lie. "If you're obstructive, we'll kill you both."
"You're making a mistake, Rob."
"Mr. Samsa will remain here with the minstrel," said Rob, unconcerned by the warning. "We I mean you and I, will go to the royal chambers. There'll be a guard. I have your sword, as you see. I'll give it back to you, and you'll deal with the sentries, and the reinforcements that the guards will summon before you kill them all. On hearing the din, the chamberman will spirit the king away through